Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin. And Ron, it's finally here!
This is the week.
I know.
It's going to happen.
Let me just say it.
It's going to happen.
Let me just say it.
It's got to happen.
Ready?
Happen sometime.
The DNC's Rules and Bylaws Committee.
I've been living for this.
Oh,
I've been living for nothing else. We are finally going to explain to the listener the underlying importance of the three most important letters in the English alphabet.
NPR?
RBC.
RBC?
RBC. RBC.
Is it a root beer? Is it a...
RBC. It stands for Rules and Bylaws Committee. And you will be there. Many other reporters will be there. Protesters in favor of Hillary Clinton's candidacy will be there. It's going to be quite a show.
The numbers still suggest that no matter what way comes out,
The numbers. You're going to talk about the numbers.
You don't want to hear about numbers.
All right. We know this much. Right now, there are 4,050 delegates to the Democratic Convention in Denver.
Mm-hmm.
If we add back in Michigan and Florida, plus all their superdelegates and all their children, then it's 398 more, which for a total of 4,448.
Ron, I'm going out for a sandwich. I'll be right back.
Okay. But we probably will not raise the number of overall total delegates to the Denver Convention by that full number, because the most likely scenario to come out of this coming up meeting of the RBC is... 50% solution.
Right.
That means that the number of delegates originally allocated to these two states, pledged delegates, would be cut in half.
Well, or they all attend, but they get half a vote.
I like that better, because I like not cutting people in half.
Me too.
Just their votes. And if that is the case, then we see how many delegates from these two states, something more like 200 or a little more than 200.
Now, Barack Obama will say that the fairest thing is that both Michigan and Florida are split 50-50 since, first of all, neither candidate campaigned there, and many voters may not have come out because they were told it wouldn't matter.
It was very uncertain whether those were going to count. In fact, we've been told for months now they wouldn't count.
Now, of course, Hillary Clinton wants the most because she won handily in both states. Now, what about this argument for Hillary Clinton? Why should Barack Obama get close to half in Michigan since he wasn't even on the ballot?
Well, because all of the candidates originally signed an agreement saying they wouldn't campaign there.
Right.
She decided to leave her name on the ballot in more or less the last moment, and in that sense stole a march on the rest of the field. But let's set aside for the moment all the moral arguments, if you will, all the ethical arguments, all the legal arguments about what should have or ought to happen in either of the two states, just for the purposes of reaching some sort of peace in the valley compromise here in the RBC and beyond. Isn't it the easiest thing to recognize her victories, give her share? Well over 50% in both states. They can send as many people as they were ever allocated, but they only get a half a vote each. That would mean he remains in the neighborhood of 150, 160 delegates ahead, picks up some more next Tuesday, and that's where we stand.
If you want to save face and you're Hillary Clinton, that's fine.
I want to save face.
You do, as you should. And basically, her argument from the beginning that let every vote count, that would be adhered to. But if she's really, it's not a question of saving face, if it's a question about winning the nomination, and she says that a 50% solution is not acceptable, she could theoretically, or perhaps even more than theoretically, go to the full Credentials Committee, which is like 368 members.
It's huge.
It's huge, more than the 30 members of the Rules Committee, and that they meet in July or August, date undetermined. And if that a decision comes out of the Credentials Committee, whatever decision they make has to be decided by the full convention in Denver in late August. The last thing the Obama camp and most Democrats want to see happening, a floor fight at the convention.
But even if the Credentials Committee were to meet in July, is there any reason to think that they would overturn the decision of the Rules and Bylaws Committee, or that they would try to change the rules in some way that would be enough to change the basic math?
No, I don't see it at all. And even though,
so what would be the point?
The point would be, according to this Hillary Clinton argument, that if they rule that Michigan and Florida have to count for something, perhaps they might even throw the popular vote in. Hillary Clinton will then have the argument, which she's always wanted.
Well, but she's making that argument already.
Right.
She already says she's won the popular vote, even without anyone agreeing with her. She'll go on saying it in any event.
But if the Rules Committee says that, yes, these two states matter and the votes do count, then her argument to the superdelegates, which have not worked so far, is that she's won the majority of the popular vote. And polls do show that states like Florida, Pennsylvania, Ohio, she's doing better against John McCain than Barack Obama.
That's right, although there may be some other states where she doesn't do as well,
right,
and she does trail him among Democrats nationally in all the polls.
Right.
So she has her arguments, but the arguments do not translate into a change in the delegate math going into the convention. So what would be the point in going on the way to the convention?
Well, I've said from the beginning that after the June 3rd primaries, she's gone. Now, you know, a lot obviously depends on Saturday's meeting, but I can't imagine the calculation changing in any measurable way.
No fundamental way. It just closes another door.
I don't think she takes it to the Credentials Committee and the full convention floor. I don't think she does that.
Okay, dream ticket. Is that the price? Does she say, I don't take this to the Credentials Committee and I don't take it to the convention floor if I'm on the ticket?
Well, there's been a lot of talk that's one of the things that Bill is asking for.
Bill seems to have been asking for it rather in public.
I think that the Barack Obama message of change and looking forward is really taken several steps back with Hillary Clinton on the ticket, not because of the Robert Kennedy reference, not because of the racial innuendo that may or may not have happened during the primary season. I think there's just bad blood, and I don't think it helps the ticket. But you could make the argument that all the people, if the party is definitely split in half, and it's certainly there's a tremendous sentiment for Hillary Clinton on the to be the nominee, you solve that problem by getting them on the same ticket. I could understand that argument, but, you know, I think of people that on paper it sounded very good, Bob Dole and Jack Kemp, two different wings of the Republican Party.
Definitely.
But they did not. There was no chemistry at all. They did not like each other.
Neither wing worked.
No, it didn't. And you don't want Bill Clinton and conspiring against you as president with Hillary Clinton on the ticket. I assume that would happen.
What's up with John McCain these days?
Who?
The Republicans' presumptive nominee. He has had the nomination essentially wrapped up since March 4th.
Right.
We keep talking about what a terrible disadvantage it is for the Democrats not to have decided on a candidate who could now have been running. But what has John McCain managed to do as the sole last Republican
standing?
Well,
you would think that he's had this time to bone up on the issues, get his staff in order, and yet so many of his staff have succumbed to conflicts of interest, of ethical lapses.
They've left
and
the campaign.
They've been forced out or resigned, exactly.
Because of their lobbying activities
right.
That didn't comport well with John McCain's positions against lobbying.
Yeah, and John McCain will say, well, there are lobbyists for Barack Obama, too. But John McCain's raison d'etre, which means where's the men's room, his reason for running, one of his signature issues is campaign finance ethics, and to have all these guys on his staff, not that they've broken any laws, but they've broken the John McCain version of the way campaigns should be run. You'd think he'd have these all sorted out before the focus goes back to John McCain.
Yes, I mean, they clearly contradicted his image, and you would think that might have been part of the vetting process before they ever took over his campaign. But they did take over his campaign last fall when it was basically on its back. He wasn't raising any money. His campaign staff had largely left. He had been written off by virtually everyone. So
you picked Sam Brownback to win the nomination.
That's right. Sam Brownback, I'm sure, was the one that I picked out. Anyway, the other things, though, that have been happening to John McCain have given us some hint of where his strengths may lie as we go forward. Among other things, he released his health records, and those health records showed no recurrence of cancer in the years since 2000. And he, according to his doctors, was not at great risk of a recurrence of cancer. So that was very good news.
Also, he's trying to mimic what the Democrats are doing. He's cutting his age in half. He's only 36 years old, not 72 years old in August, which is good.
I'm surprised his doctors were willing to go along with that.
Well, it's fair. The Democrats are doing that with the delegates in Michigan.
He's also been giving a series of speeches that are essentially challenges to Barack Obama. He is trying to point up the relative inexperience of Barack Obama on foreign policy and national security, his strong suit, and to shift the attention and the issue away from some of the economic issues or the identification that he suffers with George W. Bush that would be his weaknesses for the fall. And speaking of George W. Bush, he has had another vulnerability exposed this week in the disaffection, shall we say, the defection of one of his former inner circle staff of Texans, Scott McClellan.
What Scott McClellan said in the book, the name of the book is What Happened. Of course, George W. Bush has another book coming out saying, What Happened?
With a question.
With a question mark.
Hey, what happened?
I don't think that any...
What's the full title of the book, though?
The full title is What Happened Inside the Bush White House and What's Wrong with Washington. The thing with Scott McClellan, if you listen to what he said about politicizing the war, about Karl Rove and Scooter Libby, plotting about Valerie Plame, a lot of us pundits, smart wise guys in Inside Washington baseball. Say, well, we knew this all along, but having it come out of the Bush administration, one of his closest allies, that was the shock. I think that was the headline of the week, the fact that there would be somebody who stood before the Bush administration in the briefing room and said, you know, this is not true, blah, blah, blah. He's completely done a 180.
Yes, he has, and I think delivered a blow that was more stinging to the Bush administration, particularly the inner circle within the White House, close to the president, than any of the previous kiss and tell, if you want to call them, books written by a general, written by a member of the National Security Council, written by somebody who had
Paul O'Neill.
That's right, the Secretary of Treasury.
The Yankee outfielder.
The book written by Joe Wilson, who had been part of the pre-Iraq intelligence gathering operation. All those books that were
conflict and compromise.
Essentially the same thing about the White House that Scott McClellan now says, none of those people had ever really been confidants. So, of course, the question was put to Scott McClellan immediately, why didn't you say something about your doubts about the Iraq war back when it was all happening? And here's what he had to say.
Because of my position and my affection for the president and my belief and trust in he and his advisors, I gave them the benefit of the doubt. And looking back on it and reflecting on it now, I don't think I should have.
That was Scott McClellan talking on the NBC Today show. This prompted some pretty hurt feelings among the other Bush confidants. Dana Perino, the current press secretary, Karl Rove, of course, the longtime strategist, was almost apoplectic talking about it, called him somebody he had once known, but now he sounds like a left-wing blogger. And, of course, then there was Ari Fleischer.
His former boss.
His former boss and his predecessor as press secretary, who had this to say on NPR.
Well, there's just something about it that doesn't make any sense to me, and I'm heartbroken about this. You know, Scott was always a great deputy to me, very reliable, trustworthy, and never once did he come up to me and express any misgivings that he had or to anybody else that I know of about the war or the manner in which the White House prepared for the war.
I know it was you, Fredo. You broke my heart. You broke my heart.
Ari Fleischer, suffering from a broken heart. Do you think, Ken, that Ari Fleischer was really genuinely shocked and taken aback when he saw this memoir emerge?
I think he was genuinely angered. Clearly, the White House line is, if he had any problems about this policy, if he had any disagreements, why there was no expression of it when he was out there lying for the administration, if that's what Ari Fleischer is saying.
Yes, but don't you think that there are people in any administration, in any organization, political or otherwise, who have doubts about what's going on but don't necessarily express it, especially when it's their job to go out and pitch?
Yeah, but you know something that's interesting? McClellan is not the guy I expected to do that to. He just seemed...
He seemed like Robo-Scott most of the time.
Yeah,
he seemed to be as much a true believer as anyone inside.
Or just put something on a piece of paper and he would go out and read. I mean, Ari Fleischer...
As opposed to a radio person.
No, but Ari Fleischer would argue with the media. Scott McClellan wasn't that kind of guy. He was likable. He was amiable.
Off camera. But he was very on point on camera. He was never giving any ground whatsoever. So you're right. It was a surprise that it should come to him.
If anybody was going to break ranks...
You wouldn't have thought, Scott.
No. I would not.
But isn't that just the way? Ken, I know one thing you really want to talk about this week.
Bob Barr?
The Libertarian nominee for president.
Yes. If you're conservative and still disillusioned or unhappy with John McCain, he could be an outlet.
He could be. Is there a state in the union where Bob Barr could get enough votes to do what Ralph Nader did in Florida and New Hampshire?
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. But I do know that he is the first former member of the House to head a third-party ticket since what former House member?
Ron Paul.
That's correct.
All right. Let's talk about one of the states that you were once from, New Jersey.
All right.
How about that state? All right.
June
let's
3rd.
Be frank. What about their senior senator? Is he going to be renominated?
He will handily.
Handily.
Handily. Because, one, nobody knows in New Jersey there's a primary.
It's very hard to defeat a person if no one knows they're running.
The only person who seems to know who's running is Rob Andrews.
He would be the person running against him.
South Jersey congressman who did not want to wait for...
Did you hear the one about the South Jersey congressman?
Yeah.
He's running against Frank Lautenberg.
So anyway, Frank Lautenberg... first elected in 1982 when he was 58 years old. He ran against Millicent Fenwick, who was 72, and Frank Lautenberg said, oh, she's too old.
She's too old.
She's much too old.
And now how old is he?
He's 84.
Okay. So he's not as old as Millicent Fenwick.
And how old will he be
in
6 years?
90.
Right. Very good.
That would be 90.
That's right.
All right. So here's the real big question. Yeah. Will Frank Lautenberg be roughed up in this primary? Will he be softened up, weakened, so that he would be easy pickings for the Republicans in November?
Let me think for a second. No. Absolutely not. First of all, Dick Zimmer, the former congressman who ran against Torricelli in 1996, will probably be the Republican nominee. No shot at winning. Whoever wins this nomination...
Dick, no shot, Zimmer.
But Lautenberg is really has the whole party behind him. All the other younger members of Congress who would love to have this seat are so angry that Andrews didn't have the patience to wait for Lautenberg to step down.
That they all immediately lined up and endorsed Lautenberg.
They did, yeah.
So self-sacrificing. So I'm always inspired by the way younger politicians defer to their seniors. Kind of like in journalism.
Speaking of which...
That's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/elections.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin. And Ron, I can't wait for the Democratic National Committee's bylaws.
RBC. Oh, RBC. Okay. RBC. 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 Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.